The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We began a basic orientation to worldview thinking last time, so we're kind of halfway into that lecture. Don't worry about the number of lecture. I'm just moving through the material here. But we're still on 2.1. I'm giving some introduction here. And I told you about the different exaggerations of worldview thinking that can occur. What I didn't go over is how the basic idea for a worldview is simply from the biblical fact that God sees all. It uses the optic metaphor, and the first person to have a comprehensive worldview is not us or Abraham Kuyper or anybody else, but is the Lord God. He created the world, and you remember in the beginning it said he saw all that he had made, and it was good. It was very good. That seeing of God, of course, has an element of judgment in the sense of evaluation. God sees, and in his evaluation of what he had done, it was good. Now, God will go on to see the world, and he will go on to have a comprehensive worldview in the way no one else ever could claim to have, even when that judgment evaluation is going to be negative. You know, when God saw the corruption of the human race in the times of Noah, and he regretted having created, and he judged the world, and he restored it. And as you get to the New Testament, it continues to be a global outlook. This is now very fashionable to talk about globalization, but there it was in the first pages of Scripture and in the New Testament. God so loved the world that he gave his only son. And that love of the world, by the time you get to John's gospel, is no longer simply what theologians call the love of complacency, which means loving what he had made and being affectionately minded or gracious to what he had made. But now it means loving it redemptively, to the point where he would send Jesus Christ to save the world. So you have the creation, the fall, and the redemption, and that's in God's eye. Now we too, by analogy, of course, can know the world. We do it in recreative ways. We do it in dependence upon the way God has revealed his vision to us. But we do it trusting that we can know the world truly, though not exhaustively. In Amos, God says he doesn't do anything without revealing it to his servants, the prophets. And one of the amazing facts of Revelation is that God has graciously given us his worldview as a truth and as a challenge. As Calvin likes to put it, though he's hard on us and on himself by saying how dull we are to receive this, yet God accommodates. He lisps, as it were, to us in order to accommodate to our limitations and our fallibility. And so we know the world by analogy to the way God knows it. And that's the basis of the claim to have a worldview. Probably the greatest opponent to worldview thinking today is the claims of the postmodern condition. Now, I'm going to give you more on that later. But the postmodern condition says something like, any such truth claim is not only impossible, but it's going to be imperialistic. It's going to be maybe violent even. And since the Second World War, many people have claimed in intellectual circles and even in popular culture that worldview thinking is dangerous. It has hegemony behind it. It's going to be coercive, as we saw the other day. Now, we boldly must say the Bible gives us truth, even though we have to be very aware that worldview thinking can fall into that sort of imperialism. And there's a Christian type of imperialism, which, of course, is very dangerous. Probably the other major opponent of worldview thinking is dualism. Do you remember a number of years ago when that awful shooting occurred at Columbine in Colorado? And these two lost young men dressed in trench coats came and killed some 15 people and wounded others. And I don't know if you remember this. In the midst of it, there was a young woman named Cassie Bernal. And according to the reports and according to the book that her mother wrote about her unlikely martyrdom, one of the young men aimed this rifle at her head and asked her if she were a believer or if she believed in God or if she was a Christian. It's difficult to know exactly what the question was, but it was something in that order. And she said yes, and he assassinated her. Very moving account of the courage of this young woman, and it's made a lot of bad things have a redemptive edge to it. But in the aftermath, I was, for one, very distressed to see what a lot of American Christians did with this. There were literally hundreds of websites that said, she said yes. What will you say when somebody tempts you to smoke or whatever it might be? And just it really trivialized it, kind of using this very courageous incident as a sort of model or moralistic, come on, wake up, say yes. And most of them in the books that ensued, except for the wonderful book by her mom, were an appeal to just to do what I would call panic evangelism. Be as spiritual as possible in the sort of shortcut way of intensify everything that might be an upper story spirituality. And don't worry about this world, it's going away, it's disappearing, and so forth. Well, in a popular level, that's what you can call, in a sophisticated way, dualism. Dualism's been around since Greek philosophy. It's been around since before that, I presume. It's found in one version or another in every culture. Dualism was found in a particularly powerful way in the Middle Ages when it was thought that to attain the highest level of spirituality, indeed to enter heaven, one needed to live or at least have access to people who lived in that sort of same upper story. For example, the idea of calling or vocation was restricted to ministers, monks, nuns, religious missionaries, and so forth. They were called. They had a vocation. Everybody else was seen as in a kind of support role. And if you were called to the ministry, you gave up all earthly goods. You literally gave up your money. You couldn't marry. You devoted your life to prayer and to service. There was a famous book that is still very popular of spirituality, which has a lot of good things in it, but it captures the idea, written by Thomas A. Kempis. And the title is On the Imitation of Christ. But actually the full title is On the Imitation of Christ and the Renunciation of the World. And in it he praises people who give up everything and go into the cell, which is the monk's cell, which in Latin sounds like heaven, kailorum, and so you go into the cell to reach heaven. And when the Reformation came along, Martin Luther first in his kind of prophetic way, and Calvin and many others in a consolidating way, they really burst this apart. They said, calling is not for the religious, for monks, for priests, and so forth. Calling is for everyone. You are first, as a believer, as a saved person, called or summoned by God into his family. And that's for everybody. And second, you're called in some station in this life, be it in the workplace, as a merchant, as an artist, be it in the family, as a father or mother, child, be it as a citizen. Calling has a particular form for each person, but it's no less noble than the calling of priests. Martin Luther, in his typical way, I think it's in the Table Talk, says, the work of one householder is of far greater worth than all of the work of the priests and nuns and missionaries and monks put together. Now, I'm sure he didn't mean to be quite so extreme, but he meant to emphasize the universality of calling. And then William Perkins and Ames and others famously developed this idea. How do you recognize your calling? How do you confirm it? How do you develop it? And really, the beginnings of the modern worldview thinking, which opposes dualism, began at this point. And so, the second kind of broad enemy of worldview thinking is dualism. Now, this comes up in your reading, and you'll come up with it, you'll come against it all the time. And I don't mean to give a term that you can use to accuse people who haven't figured out worldview yet, but there is a lot of dualism in the church and in much of our Christian mentality. Worldview thinking is meant to say, no, there's something comprehensive about being a Christian. It affects all areas of life. Now, to get a sense of it, let's look a little bit at the most recent history of how worldview thinking developed in Protestant circles, and then we'll see why this is so fascinating and also, I think, such an important antidote to dualism as well as to postmodernism. There is a fellow, remarkable statesman, scholar, theologian, historian, named Groen van Prinsterer. Green, okay, that's his name, Green. It always sounds better in, you know, some foreign language, you know, like Giuseppe Verdi. Isn't that a wonderful name? Basically means Joe Green, okay? But Groen van Prinsterer was this statesman whose one of his major contributions to scholarship was a very thoughtful critique of the French Revolution. Now, the French Revolution, in a negative way, shaped much of the thinking of Protestants who would develop worldview thinking. Groen wrote a book about revolution and the spirit of unbelief, or unbelief and the spirit of revolution, in which he said that while there were many understandable reasons for the French Revolution, which, as you know, began in 1789 and moved on through the Reign of Terror until Napoleon was able to come and put some order into the picture, there were nevertheless deeper, more spiritual reasons for the French Revolution, at the heart of which was sans Dieu ni loi, okay? Without God, or neither with God nor law. And he traced this spiritual motif of rebellion against God and law intellectually back to some of the philosophes like Diderot or Voltaire or others who were less known to us, who are less known to us, but better known in the local setting. Now, Paris at the dawn of the Revolution is a fascinating place to study. People are still writing about this city. The city of Paris was really the capital, the intellectual capital of Europe. It wasn't that big a place. It's less than half the size of Brooklyn. And yet, in that city, partly because people are all living in very small quarters, and partly because it's such a brilliant city with such a brilliant history, it's part citizenship and part drama, part show, part theater. Paris still is, but it was, especially then, a great theater of people performing and saying dramatic things. And there was never a more dramatic moment than the eve of the French Revolution. Just to give you one example, if you go to the Grand Palais, the palace which was inhabited by the Bourbon kings, they had opened up a part of it as a kind of a entertainment, almost a mall, a kind of a garden, a sort of park on the inside, and then around the sides were all these little shops and cafes. Now, Paris is full of cafes. I know I have one acquaintance who lives in a tiny, tiny little place in an apartment in Paris, and it's something like 12 by 9 surface. So if somebody comes to see him, he says, let's go to the living room, which means they'll go downstairs to the cafe, because that's his living room. Now, these cafes around the Palais had names. One of them was Café Mécanique, and it was a technological place where robots brought your food from inside to outside. And there was one called Café Foi, faith, where you debated issues of faith. Journalism was strong. People read the daily papers. And in those days, the daily papers contained all this hot philosophical material, which really was anti-authority and eventually would lead to the overthrow. Now, without going into a whole lot more details, there was this foment. There was a sense of, we want change. We want to overthrow. But the big reductionism is that the enemy is anything in the ancient regime. The enemy is the king, the monarchy. The enemy is the Roman Catholic Church. They have been keeping people down. If we could only overthrow that, we will have freedom and progress. And as you know, in the French Revolution, devised a death machine, which is supposed to be humane, called the guillotine. It was invented by a piano maker. It was not only meant to be humane because painless and rapid, but it was a dramatic way to cut off the past, literally. It was set up in what is now the Place de la Concorde, and this was a public spectacle. People who were the enemies of the revolution were paraded in these carts, and they were expected to make last speeches, then they were cut off. And soon, one enemy after another was cut off, right to the king. And then even some of the early revolutionaries were cut off by the later revolutionaries. Nobody was good enough. And one thing led to another, and it turned out that the program of the revolution was it had a negative enemy, but it didn't have much of a positive program. So they began to try to make substitutes for what they had killed off. The newspapers became a substitute for the Bible. The guillotine became a substitute for the atonement. The worship at Notre Dame Cathedral is interesting. They destroyed the main altar in the middle of the cathedral and put in its place a pile of dirt. And instead of the cross, they had a tree on it. This was to symbolize nature and regeneration. And instead of the processional being priests and the crucifer, it was revolutionary people carrying on a large stretcher a woman who was a local prostitute dressed as a deity in honor of reason. And she was worshipped with revolutionary hymns as the goddess of reason. So what you had here is a religious substitution of an old regime for a new one, which was hardly religious. It was just another religion, the religion of reason. Now, Horin van Prinsler saw all this, and he wrote and studied it. And this led his most admiring disciple, Abraham Kuyper, we started talking about him the other day, to explore further the whole idea of a religious ground motive, a religious basis that underlies the more visible parts of culture and political movement. Now, Kuyper, as I mentioned the other day, in 1898, I think I said 99, but it was really in 1898, was invited to come over to Princeton and deliver a series of lectures. And originally, the lectures were about a Calvinistic view of history. But by the time he came around to publishing these lectures, he wanted them to be entitled something like Calvinism, a Life System. And in the Stone Foundation lectures, Kuyper develops the idea of a worldview. He believed that world and life view was a better term. And he also liked James Orr's view of the world. But he chose life system because he really wanted to translate the global sense that the German word Weltanschauung represented. Weltanschauung has origins in Kant. Maybe it goes back even before. And when Kant used it, Immanuel Kant, it wasn't really this Christian idea that God sees the world and therefore we can know by analogy and there's a spiritual principle that underlies everything. It was more a way to relativize various peoples around the world. In other words, that's his worldview, or that's the tribal worldview of such and such a tribe, or that's the French worldview. It was a way to rationalize, to understand, to put into categories the different ways different people think in groups. Nevertheless, it did have this systematic understanding. It was meant to cover everything. And the term Weltanschauung, or worldview, was particularly a favorite of a group of philosophers, beginning with Kant, known as the idealists. Now, the idealists include a number of different people, Bradley, Hegel, Bosanquet, many others. And basically, like the French Revolution, they had substituted for the biblical God a bigger principle that, as they believe, called the ideal, the absolute, the other. Hegel had this huge concept of the absolute. He even believed history was moving towards the absolute, which would be a kind of ultimate spirit, rational universe. Kuiper, of course, heartily disagreed with all that. And he saw in them not Christians at all, but pantheists. Because what do pantheists do? Well, pantheists believe that everything is a kind of extension of God. Or you don't have to call it God, you could call it something else. Pantheists believe that everything is contained in everything else. And he didn't agree with that at all, but he liked the idea that there was a interconnectedness in all things. And so taking Grun's idea of the French Revolution, he expanded this into thinking that Christianity is well placed in the 19th century to understand itself as a life system and to understand the alternative views as life systems which were simply not regenerate. Spent a lot of time describing the essence of the Christian worldview as regenerate, palingenesis, because this regenerating process was not just once for all, but was characterizing Christians together and in the church and as they grew and so on. And non-Christians as the unregenerate, and that characterized their growing worldviews. Now, I don't want to say much more about Kuiper's role in this. He's a key figure. He's been enormously influential on people like Dooyeweerd, Cornelius Van Til, indirectly, of course, on Francis Schaeffer, Oz Guinness, and many other apologists. And he's constantly being rediscovered because of his seminal work. I may have mentioned we had a student here do a doctoral dissertation on his articles in The Standard, which was a newspaper that he founded, making apologetic commentary on all of life around him. He also founded the Free University of Amsterdam. And that was meant to be a university whose teachers and whose subject matter was based on the Christian world and life view. And so, without going into a whole lot more details on him, this is something of the historic origins of worldview thinking and how it got into to the Christian community. Now, in its recent history, you have these seminal figures, but let me mention just a word about religion and culture here. Worldview thinking was not only developed by Christians, but got a lot of help from outside the church, notably from anthropologists. Worldview is a concept in cultural anthropology used to compare and characterize cultures in a holistic manner. It seeks to recognize the sum of ideas and norms and emotional reactions of a group or individuals to the universe that surrounds them. Now, there was a famous 20th century anthropologist named Robert Redfield who brought this a step forward by studying the people of the Yucatan. And he found that this Native American culture was at grips with Spanish, then with modern urban cultures, as well as their own. And he felt incurable wounds had been inflicted on their past. And he spent his career trying to protect what was left. And the way he did it was to try to rescue their worldview.
This is the end of side one. Please flip the tape at this point.
Now, as he developed it, he found that every different culture has certain things in common. For example, every culture distinguishes one part of the self from another. You might call it self-consciousness or a dialogue with the self. Every culture has some definition of what it is to be human or what it is not to be human. There's classes, social groups, kinships. Every culture has some entity like God or supernatural forces or a sacred in distinction from other entities that are dependent on that. The orientation of the self in time and space. Crises are accounted for and solved by certain worldview processes. Putting all this together, you get a kind of worldview understanding of every culture. And Redfield urged people not to violate one another's worldviews. Now, of course, this feeds into a certain relativism, obviously, and some of it is a bit too neat, and some of it ignores the fact that he himself has a worldview, which in a way is claiming a higher place than some of the ones that he's studying. Nevertheless, a lot of promising insights come out of his work and the work of other anthropologists. So that today, when we're doing worldview thinking, it's appropriate to look for a people's questions about God, ways to resolve crises, understanding of the self, so that we're speaking to people in an existential situation. This was further advanced in anthropology by an amazing man named Clifford Geertz, Hertz. And he, just to make a long story short, broadened the idea of worldview to meaning systems, symbol systems, ethics. And he went around the world and studied things that anthropologists had hitherto not studied particularly, such as Balinese cockfighting and funerals in various parts of the world. You can learn a lot from doing field work in funerals and having your informants tell you what they feel. In some cultures, you know, it's very appropriate to weep and to wail. In others, not at all. You keep it inside. The person you grieve for differs from culture to culture. And behind all of that is a whole complex which he said has to be described in thick description. The tendency in Redfield was you got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, whatever characteristics, kinship groups, concept of God, and so forth. Geertz says, actually, culture is richer, more complex, more dynamic than that. And you've got to go in there and look at all these aspects in relation, and then you can step back and do your cultural analysis. Now, these anthropologists are a step along the way to helping us to do better worldview thinking. If you have not read Harvey Kahn's book, Eternal Word and Changing Worlds, you have a treat coming to you. For he takes this Geertzian anthropology and he shows how Christians can work with that as they try to understand the life perspective or the confessional vision of different peoples so that we can do evangelism, we can do missions, we can understand how to do theology, we can respect other cultures in doing theology and not simply bring to them, lock, stock, and barrel, a Scottish Presbyterian heritage or a Dutch Reformed heritage or an American Evangelical heritage and say, look, this is what you need, let's help you with it. You work in partnerships. Now, maybe this can get very confusing. And for sure, we don't all have to become professional anthropologists in order to do missions. But it is a remarkable, helpful tool that is available to us. Now, how would you define worldview? For Christians, Van Til called it a philosophy of life, but it's more than philosophy, isn't it? It's a confessional vision. I think a simple but elegant definition is in the Walters book. He says it's worldview is the comprehensive framework of one's basic beliefs about anything. Or more elaborately, a worldview or vision of life is a framework or set of fundamental beliefs through which we view the world and our calling and future in it. He and many others, of course, add that this does not have to be articulated. We often hold our worldviews without knowing we have them. And that one of the jobs of apologetics is often to simply help people identify their worldviews. One of my neighbors, we often have conversations about things of faith. He's a Jew who is not a practicing Jew at all. He's a skeptic, and he always tells me that he's a complete skeptic, doesn't believe anything. And I'm always trying to say, but you do. Even skepticism is a worldview. You're sitting in a certain place where, according to certain criteria, you're able to see things in other people that you might not agree with. And he always says, no, I'm even skeptical about that. But, you can back up a long ways, but you're still resting on something eventually. So worldviews are a way of seeing. And, of course, they have many, many different determinants. As I will argue later in the course, a worldview is not simply a philosophical point of view. A worldview could be the way you feel about something. It might be in some part of popular culture. A worldview might be held by somebody who's starving and doesn't know where to go for food and becomes desperate in that search. A worldview, in other words, is informed by many, many, many different things, not just a conscious philosophy. And I guess one of the tasks that we have as apologists today is to recognize that and not just reduce worldviews to some clear-cut statement that the person will have to own up to. I think maybe an older generation would have tended to do that, whereas we, with our more anthropologically informed view, we can go beyond that, but without neglecting the whole. Now, one more thing, and I'll get your question. Absolutely. Hold on to it. I started on this a little bit last time, but I want to try to establish the balance once again. Culture has many determinants, or brings many features into your worldview. At the basis of a worldview is a religious vision. Life as religion is, or life is religion is the title of a wonderful book, a Festschrift in honor of a Reformed Christian. And so everything in one way or another does come down to one's religious commitments. My colleague Dave Powlison at CCEF likes to use the image of a tree. And if you're taking any counseling courses, you won't go far before you see this image. And he sees roots, then there's the trunk, and then there's the branches and the leaves. We've got your presuppositions here, your heart condition or your religion in the roots. It's rooted. And from those roots, which are not always visible, spring a life system, bringing the life of that religion up to the more visible portions in your moral behavior, in your cultural behavior, in your church going or not, and so forth. The tree has an advantage as an image because it shows that it's organic. Worldviews move. They don't just, there's not just one thing that you stop with. Leaves grow. If there's a lot of sun, they can grow in a certain direction. If the conditions of the soil are such, they can be stunted in their growth and so on. So worldviews are not just, you know, James Sire wrote a marvelous book that I think a lot of people have benefited from, The Universe Next Door. But there's maybe a little tendency there to have, you know, there's a chapter on this, there's a chapter on that, there's a chapter on dualism, chapter on rationalism and so forth. It seems to me what's missing in that otherwise wonderful book is the dynamic aspect, the organic growth, changing aspect of worldviews. But having said that, let's be very careful not to fall into imperialism. We've got you figured out. We know your religion. We've got your number. And here's what it's going to look like. We can predict what you're going to do based on that. There is, of course, before God, who sees everything, there is a heart to be seen, and we will be judged on that heart. But we don't get to do that. We get to probe and spend a lot of time with people and dig deeper and walk in their moccasins for a long time and try to share things in order to help them identify this and see whether they like it or not, and repentance is in order or not. So one more plea for humility. There's a tendency in some groups, in some theological groups like theonomy, to have an answer for everything. Here's the verse for this. There's a law for that. And we recognize the Bible can be very specific, but it also can be very principial. And you need wisdom as well as verses to figure that out with people. Okay, pause for questions. Who had, I'll go along with that. Macro and micro or cultural versus individual. And as you say, there's going to be a lot of overlap because we are, to some extent, products of our environment. But we individuals have variants. No two worldviews are ever exactly alike because no two people are exactly alike. It's the individual and the collectivity thing. Of course, there are patterns and trends. And Van Til suggests, you know, to the annoyance of his critics, that there's only two, basically. There's the Christian philosophy of life, and there's the varieties of the non-Christian philosophy of life. And think about it. In a way, the Bible tells us, ultimately, there's only two kinds of people. Those who are called of God and respond in faith, and those who don't. So, you know, without falling into imperialism, I think that there's something to say for that. Yes. Right. Very good question. Postmodernism and dualism are worldviews, aren't they? And why are they opposed to worldviews? The opposition that postmodernism has to worldview thinking is a claim that says it can't be done or shouldn't be done. It's a claim which ultimately, I think, falls on its own grounds. The postmodernists that I've studied all somewhere have a worldview, and many of them will acknowledge it and try to just do something that doesn't group people together too violently. But it's a claim, not a reality. Dualism is certainly a worldview. Dualism opposes the idea of that a worldview perspective presents that all spheres of life can have a Christian interpretation. I think it's a wrong worldview, but it's a worldview anyway. It tends to minimize or to just relegate to the world or to some lower story all the spheres of life that are in the support roles to vocation, you know, whether it be money matters or politics. The dualistic worldview tends to look down on those and say the real business of the kingdom is spiritual. But I think in doing so, it too is simply exercising a worldview function, just an unbiblical one. So I agree. That's very helpful. Oh, eternal word and changing worlds. It's a wonderful book. It takes you through the history of anthropology and in three sets of consciousnesses, consciousness 1, 2, and 3, and shows how Christians have interfaced with those. And he pleads that we pay more attention to consciousness 3, which is the Geertz stuff and so on. It won all kinds of awards. I mean, it was, Christianity Today's bestseller or book of the year or something. Very, very wonderful legacy there. Anybody else? I can't get started on a new topic, so this is a good time for questions. All right, yeah. Well, no, I'm arguing that the worldview includes the invisible heart commitments and the visible fruits in the human being. And I'm arguing that the background of being able to say anything about a worldview is that there's God who sees everything. And in the Christian worldview, we believe not only that God is there, but there are invisible powers in the world which condition, or don't condition, but they influence the visible. So I would want to give full space to what you're calling the invisible. Okay, we'll see you on Friday.